of London and Manchester, with cities such as Bradford, Bath, and Nottingham, among others, playing host to those protests. 18 arrests were made in Manchester city center, where the protesters had blocked the tram service. And it's become a thing, really. These protests all begin peacefully up until the riot police arrive with their riot gear and their horses and dogs, and the protests descend into violence. And police, we have seen from the footage, have really been heavy-handed in their treatment of those demonstrators. Today's protests really follow another one that happened in Bristol, a place that's seen other protests as well over the past couple of weeks. 10 arrests were made there after the demonstration descended into violence as well after the police arrived. The police in Bristol have really come under fire for their treatment of the demonstrators and for an attack on a journalist, journalist named Matthew Dretch, who works for the Daily Mirror, has posted a video of himself coming under attack by the police, who were there with their batons and shields, even as he told them that he was a member of the media. As you say, the controversial policing bill is being debated on in Parliament. It will have to clear another vote and survive another vote in the House of Commons of the British Parliament. Then it will move on to the House of Lords, and finally it will have to get or gain royal assent before it is written into law. The government has supported the actions of the police. The Prime Minister has come out, Boris Johnson, calling what happened in Bristol as disgraceful. But the fact of the matter is that these protesters are out there to stay, and they're saying that they're going to continue doing what they have been doing, which is opposing this bill, forcing a rethinking of it all by the government. But we know that the fact that the government has a majority in Parliament will really give it a strong hand in getting this bill through the legislature and turning it into law. But the critics, among them politicians on the left, are saying that really what this bill does is curtail freedoms, freedom of expression, of speech, like how noisy a protest can be, and things that go with it. And they're also saying that the day that this bill is written into law will be a day that the UK, as a democracy, will turn into a dictatorship, Kisu.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Saeed Fureza, joining us from London. And also, we have investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who's joining us from Bristol. Now, Mr. Gosling, why was the police bill proposed in the first place? Seems that the police already have enough powers.
Well, funnily enough, parts of the bill the police themselves said they didn't want. And it's a very good report by your journalist there. But one thing he missed out is there's a very, very important part of this, what is being called now here the Police State Bill, which is to do with trespass and criminalising trespass. That's one of the protests which the police were particularly violent at, even though the demonstrators in Bristol were sitting down with their hands in the air, with their hands up, you know. The police still went in with the dogs, arrested 14 or so of them. Many of, you know, that's something like, you know, one in 20 of the people who were there. So this is another aspect. And the timing is interesting, isn't it? Because this is all being pushed through under a lockdown. And so the mayor of Bristol, the mayor of London, the police chiefs, etc., and Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who I think is really the one main person behind the police violence, are saying, oh, well, you can't protest because of a lockdown. Well, you know, the 20,000 or so people in Bristol who are about to be criminalised by this bill, of course they are going to protest. They're not going to say, well, we'll wait until the lockdown's finished and then we will, because this is the crucial stage. We're going through into the committee stage of the bill in Parliament, and at that point, this is the point where you need to make your voice heard, and you need to say to the police and to the media and to the general public and to the politicians, we're not going to stand for this bill. You know, there's a whole bunch of people been involved in this Kill the Bill protest movement, which has sprung up literally over the last month or so. But the thing is, this word "kill the bill," let me explain for your viewers, the bill is the old bill in Cockney rhyming slang. It is what we use to refer to the police. So "kill the bill" has a connotation of killing the police. So that's why it's a bit of a cheeky word to use. But actually, of course, it's the bill they're referring to, this police state bill that they want to kill. Now, this was something that I was involved, actually, as a journalist and as a marcher back in 1994 in the Criminal Justice Act in Britain, which was the first step towards what they're trying to do to completely criminalise trespass in Britain, where they got rid of free parties. They brought in something called aggravated trespass, where the police would get more involved. Usually it's just up to the landowner to do something about it if someone turns up on their land. So there is an echo right back to the 1990s, and really what this bill is trying to do is to pick up on those the criminalisation of trespass that happened back then and make it actually a permanent thing. In fact, it's very similar to the law in the United States, and quite a lot of what we do in Britain is they have criminal trespass laws in the US which are very similar. But we in Britain have had travelling people, itinerant people, squatters, etc., for thousands of years, since time immemorial. And this is the first time there's ever been an attempt in Britain to turn all those people into criminals. And that's why I think there's been such a move against the police, particularly demonstrations, peaceful and some not so peaceful, to show the strength of feeling, to send a very clear message that they're not going to use a lockdown to stop a demonstration against this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. Let's also turn to journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who is with us from Plymouth. Mr. Tweedy, why is the British government pushing for this bill, despite the backlash, all these protests that we see all across the UK?
Well, I mean, there's more than one backlash, perhaps. I mean, if you're going to protest, you have to be careful that you don't alienate the majority and by causing so much mess and inconvenience and damage to the cities where you're protesting, and that's what happened in Bristol to a large extent. They were smashing up people's private cars. My fellow guest here has mentioned the meaning of kill the bill. You know, I mean, it is essentially an advert to anarchists to come and have a fight with the police, which sometimes the police are quite happy to do, by the way. But these protests are. They've kind of jumped the shark and they're likely to alienate people, so it's a problem. The bill is, like a lot of crime bills in Parliament, it contains a lot of very disparate elements, and some of those are new laws to prevent violent criminals and sex offenders and people convicted of terrorist offences too from being released halfway through their sentence on license, on parole, right? They're going to have to wait until two-thirds through their sentence, if this bill passes, to be released. And that's something that's actually very difficult for anyone on the government benches or in the opposition to argue against. In fact, the opposition has said that they agree with that, basically. And they abstained on the first vote against this bill, but the second is, on the second one they voted against it, but because of what happened on Clapham Common a few days earlier, and that when the vigil for a woman who was murdered, Sarah Everard, was broken up by the Metropolitan Police, the London Police, but that what happened there was done under rules, with special lockdown rules, which essentially make all large...
Well, actually, it's interesting that
illegal.
You pointed... to that particular incident. Well, all of this comes at a time that it's in the wake of actually the murder of Sarah Everard, who was instantly murdered by a police officer on her way back home. And that would sound the alarm, one would think, for the parliamentarians, to be more cautious about the type of bill that they would bring into law. That doesn't seem to be the case, though, Mr. Tweedy, does it?
But the bill was drafted long before that happened. It was drafted, this debate's been going on for a year or two now, what happened there was that the Metropolitan Police went over the top, and the Metropolitan Police is the commissioner, the chief inspector of that police force is Cressida Dick, and Cressida Dick was in charge of the operation that in back in 2007, which saw an innocent man killed. A Brazilian immigrant was apparently mistaken for British Bangladeshi. John Charles Jimenez, and he was killed. And then the police leaked stuff to the media and told lies about it. So this person, who was, by the way, promoted by members of the Labour Party, she was in charge. You see, and okay, so there are these rules that have been introduced during the lockdown against large public gatherings, and the police have been applying them selectively. And it's okay for the police to have that discretion, but on that occasion, it was very obvious, you know, they'd allowed a lot of very large and angry protests and marches and things to go ahead, and then this thing was a silent, static vigil in a park at night when there weren't a lot of people around, and they broke it up quite forcefully for some reason. I don't understand why they did that at all.
Well, exactly. Mr. Gosling, I think you could comment on that, please.
That's right. We now know why. It's because The Guardian got a leaked memo from the Home Office explaining that it was directly Priti Patel herself that had written a memo to the Metropolitan Police asking for them, or in fact, she's not really asking, is she? She's telling them to shut this vigil down for Sarah Everard. I mean, she's a provocateur. But let's not forget that Priti Patel, back in 2017, was sacked for 12 illegal meetings with the Israeli government when she was the DFID secretary, that's the foreign aid secretary, and she was sacked for those, including one of the things she was trying to do secretly when she was said she was on a private holiday, she was secretly meeting with all these Israeli officials. One of the things she tried to do was to get British public money for the Israeli army in the Golan Heights. Now, she is a traitor for having those meetings, and she should never have been allowed back into government. And now she's actually managing to steal a march on Boris, really, by making him look stupid, and he hasn't got the guts to sack her. He should sack her right now for ordering the police into that vigil on Clapham Common. It's one of the most disgusting bits of policing we've ever seen in Britain, and it's no part of a democracy. This is police state policing being done specifically by Priti Patel, and we've got the memo, we've got the evidence that it was her behind it.
And honestly, Mr. Gosling, it's very paradoxical for us outside the UK to see police violence in response to peaceful protesters that are concerned about exactly that. So what kind of message do you think this is sending the world?
Well, what we're seeing here is, I think, a real hiatus in British politics at the moment. It all depends on whether Boris has got the guts to sack the traitors within his own cabinet, but I don't think he has. I think he's a very weak prime minister. And what we'll see, I think, in the next few months is we're going to see more and more confrontations over this particular Act of Parliament. Just think how reckless and stupid it is of Priti Patel to be pushing a bill through which is going to make at least 20,000 people in Bristol, that is the people who have got their housing problems, that were sort of homeless, people that cannot afford to either pay a mortgage or pay the rent. We've got something like 20,000 of them in Bristol officially homeless. She's going to try and turn them all into criminals. The idea here, of course, is to turn the forces of government on the poor. And what's also been going on at the same time is complete impunity for criminals who are rich. Particularly, we're talking here about bankers. And in Bristol, we've got the Lloyds Bank, the business support unit, which has been accused by former police officers and by campaigners and people who've lost their property of fraud, very much like the Reading fraud that was also being done by Lloyds Bank several years ago, and people were prosecuted and jailed for. They're not being jailed in Bristol. So what we're seeing here is the machinery of criminal justice being turned from the criminals onto the most vulnerable in society. And I think that really is a recipe, if it's not stopped, for civil war in Britain.
And it is actually very interesting. Mr. Tweedy, the rules set out in the bill can be applied to a demonstration of just one person. What exactly does that mean?
Well, okay, I mean, maybe it can be any kind of demonstration can be shut down, but actually we've had rules more or less to that effect for a long time now. It's been very difficult to organize protests In London, you have to get, outside Parliament, for instance, or outside 10 Downing Street, you have to get permission. I mean, in practice, they've gone ahead, for sure. It's been done, but you have to. But these are rules that were introduced about 20 years ago, which there are already restrictions on the right to protest. It's not unfettered. We could turn to other things. I mean, there's been a certain amount of controversy about the part of the bill which increases the penalties for vandalising public property, in particular monuments, not other forms of public property, but monuments. There's a thing. I mean, why has that been written into this bill? It's because some middle-class white people who were attending a Black Lives Matter protest decided that it would be funny to graffiti a statue of Winston Churchill, and then there was other graffiti put on a statue of Gandhi and on the cenotaph on a war memorial. You see, so we have this thing where Britain is full of memorials to war memorials, and of course most of them commemorate at some point, or many of them commemorate the Second World War, which is the war against fascism, in which we were led by Winston Churchill, because that's the history of it. And there are other memorials to the volunteers who went to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side against the Falangists and the Carlists, the fascists, basically. And these memorials are now, vandalizing these memorials could get you 10 years in jail now.
Exactly, 10 years in jail. Quite a penalty. Mr. Gosling, don't you think so?
Well, look, the main reason they're doing this is because of what happened last year at the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol, where the statue of Edward Colston was pulled down and thrown into the docks. And there have been many of us, historians like myself, who have been calling for this statue to be put somewhere less prominent, maybe in a museum or something like that, for many years, and they've been ignored. Edward Colston was a slave trader, but his name is all over Bristol. Colston Hall, there's various other places, Colston Hill. So he is almost, it's Colston Tower. There's various places around Bristol commemorating this slave trader. And he is supposed to be some sort of great guy. Of course, he wasn't. He was making money from misery and racism, as many, of course, were in those times. And so I think
pretty
it's absolutely right
that
there was some kind of challenge,
Mr. Gosling,
to this being a prominent person. And that's why they've done this, I think. That's the only reason. Look, I think this is, in a way, a bit of a side issue, because this bill, what it will do is it will give the police discretion as to which demonstrations they close down. Of course, that demonstration I'm talking about last year wasn't closed down. There were just a handful of police around. If we get to the situation where the police can pick and choose who they like and who they don't like, if there's a particular, say, for example, an anti-police demonstration, they come in with the riot police. If it's Extinction Rebellion, they start dancing with the demonstrators, then this is a police state. And that's what most people are objecting to when they say kill the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. There's one final question. We really don't have that much time, so Mr. Tweedy, if you could please make it quick. Why do you think there's so much rush on voting on this bill? Why not give parliamentarians more time to scrutinize it?
I don't think it is being rushed. I mean, it's only just passed the second reading, and now it's in the House of Lords, and that will take a long time. They'll make amendments to it, and that will go back to Parliament. And if the government doesn't want to accept those amendments, so it's going to be a long period of tenets where they
So you do believe that there will be enough time to scrutinise the bill?
Yeah, there's plenty of time to scrutinise it. It's been published and people can read it. The question is, why did the Labour Party abstain on it in the first place and then vote against it the second time? It's just because of what happened on Clapham Common. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The Labour Party is playing a political game. Firstly, their political game was not opposed to government.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
Gosling, just one final question, make it quick. Are you as optimistic as Mr. Tweedy? Do you think there will be enough time to make changes to this bill?
Well, there'll be many more demonstrations, and that's what we're going to be seeing, because we've got something like a million people, particularly, most of the arrests at these demonstrations have been Basically, young people between the ages of about 16, 18 and 22, 25. I've seen the figures of, you know, the ages of people arrested in Bristol. We're talking here about the young people are scared about their future. They think that there is no future for them. There's no jobs. There's not the education they're getting is very poor. And so they're saying, if we cannot actually demonstrate against changes that we believe which are going to affect our future, then we are going to make some changes right now. And I think that the youngsters have decided that this bill is simply not going to go through, and they'll stop at almost nothing to make sure they send a very strong signal to our politicians that they are going to be there on the barricades, and we could even have a civil war, as I said. If you're going to make up to a million people who can't afford rent and mortgage, criminals, then, of course, you're going to have a serious problem on your hands, and I don't think the government really wants that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol, and journalist and commentator James Tweedy out of Plymouth. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Debate, and also thanks for following us.
Allama Hassanzada Amuli is not only actually a philosopher, but a very comprehensive scholar that we have. And he is amazingly expert in many different fields of Islamic studies, and not only Islamic studies, but also different branches of sciences, for example, mathematics, fiqh.
We always need a teacher, and especially in the field of mysticism, you
yes.
cannot obviously grow unless until you have a teacher. So we definitely need a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he had his own teachers, the way he remembered his teachers, and the way he talks about his teachers obviously shows that the role of teacher was very important in his life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher, which is an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. Namely, for this episode, we want to talk about Ayatollah Allama Hassan Hassanzadeh Amuli. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Reza Zadeh, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The distinction that is made between Irfan Amali and Nazari, mm-hmm. I mean the theoretical Irfan and the practical one.
Yes.
And it seems that Allama Hassanzadeh Amuli himself is a practicer of what he preaches. This is a problem,
yeah.
unfortunately, we have in some of the religious, we can say, gathering nowadays. There are so many scholars who talk beautifully about beautiful concepts of Irfan, but
yes.
when it gets to the practice, there is no practice.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is an important question that needs to be answered. I think it is important for us to know what is the distinction between these two different types of Irfan.
That's right.
Scholars talk about Irfan Amali and Irfan Nazari, practical mysticism and theoretical mysticism. And what's the point? I mean, what is the meaning of that? So this is a scholarly classification. When you want to look to an entity, to a phenomenon in a scholarly way, and you want to make it clear for the learners of that, these types of classifications and explanations emerge.
That's right.
Scholars say that we have two different types of Irfan. Practical mysticism is a type of do's and don'ts based on the foundations, based on the principles of mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if a mystic is a mentor, a spiritual mentor, starts giving instructions to his students about what they need to do in order to elevate in their spirituality and mysticism,
that's right.
those practical do's and don'ts, this is one of the definitions.
Okay.
Those practical do's and don'ts are called, if you gather them,
mm-hmm.
those set of do's and don'ts
yes.
are called practical mysticism.
These are the guidelines
exactly
that usually
yes.
a mentor or a teacher gives to their students.
For example, Khwaja Abdullah Ansari has a book on
okay.
that, and they give guidelines.
Yes.
If you follow those guidelines, you grow
yes.
in your spiritual levels,
yes.
and the spiritual and mystical growth is achieved
is
by
achieved.
Following those guidelines.
Yes. But those guidelines in Islam are completely under the shadow and under the umbrella of religious obligations.
That is very true, because we talked about it, that the real mysticism is something that needs to be in line with religion in our previous program.
Okay.
But then it comes to the theoretical mysticism. What is theoretical, sir?
This is Irfan al-Nazari now.
This was, Irfan al-Nazari. When someone engages in Irfan al-Amali and in practical mysticism and starts doing all of those spiritual exercises, after a while, after a long time of being committed to all of those instructions and being a pious person and doing a lot of self-purification, as we mentioned, a knowledge is gained from within.
Okay.
That knowledge is something which is inside the soul and the mind of the mystic itself.
That's right.
So far we don't have anything out of that. But what happens then? The mystic himself starts describing what he knows and describing the whole world and the universe and God and everything based on his intuitional knowledge. This description is called theoretical mysticism. So theoretical mysticism is actually a mystical description of the world. It's a worldview which is rooted in the mystical experiences.
Is it so? I thought it is vice versa. I mean, Irfan Nazari does not have any root in Irfan Amali.
This is something that many people think that way.
Yes,
but if you do more research on that and you look at the words of the scholars, I try to be as clear as
possible in defining it
so that it makes it very clear for our dear listeners. So yes, that is not the case that Irfan al-Nazari has nothing to do with Irfan al-Amali. No.
Oh.
Actually, the true Irfan al-Nazari, for example, when someone, a mystic, starts describing the word and giving a worldview to you, where does it come from?
Oh.
It's the result of his or her spiritual experiences.
Okay.
That those spiritual experiences gives that person a worldview. Let's say expression.
That's right.
Expressing that those ideas that are in the soul of that, in the mind of that person, the result of that would be a knowledge.
So all these nazariyat and the theories that people like Allama Hasanzadeh Amuli are telling to his students and disciples and the people around are Irfan al-Nazari, but they are based on the personal intuitions and practices of himself.
And that is the very accurate definition of Irfan al-Nazari and Irfan al-Amali. So if something is based on the illusions, like many delusional people, people who have everything comes to their mind and they mix everything with together and they want to give you Irfan. No, that has nothing to do with real mysticism that we talk about.
Thank you very much for this distinction.
You're very welcome.
Let me get to Said Mohsen now. Do you believe in this definition Dr. Rezazadeh said, or like me, we can't say took the wrong approach? Because till now, I believe that Irfan al-Nazari has nothing to do with Irfan al-Amali. These are two different things. Some people are only expert in Irfan al-Nazari and just in theory they are active and powerful, but if we get to the practices they are weak. But as Dr. Rezazadeh said, no, it is a different, you know, it has roots.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the example that you gave of some people who are good in Nazari and like theoretical thought and some of them are in practical, it's because obviously nowadays the scholars that we see or the people who are talking about the theoretical Irfan, they have read the books of the previous, we can say, Urafa.
Okay.
For example, Khaja Nasiruddin, Tusi, we have Ibn Arabi, we have
and Mullah Sadra.
Mullah Sadra. The point is that those people who wrote those books, where they got these ideas from, this path which they are showing to us, for example, the books of Ibn Arabi or Khaja Nasiruddin, when we read it, where did they got this from?
So these scholars are the same.
They're
Muqarrar. Is it Muqarrar, you say?
This is an important point. You know, those people, you can become an expert in theoretical mysticism by reading the books that they have written. So Irfan al-Nazari itself is rooted in the experiences.
Yes.
But when it is written and it is like a knowledge or a field of study, your misunderstandings maybe come from that.
That's right.
So
that's right.
you can start reading those books without being committed to practical mysticism at all and learn all of those principles.
But the spiritual perfection, Said Mohsen, needs practices.
It is.
I mean, only through reading the text of the Irfan, you cannot become mystic.
You know, we have a definition of ilm, knowledge. And the knowledge, obviously, generally when I define it, I say, like, we gather a lot of information.
That's right.
We have a lot of information. You know, the way there is a raw material, and then when it is processed, it becomes a kind of profession. Information is that we read a lot of books, we know about the history, we know about the like theoretical part of the, we can say, mysticism or Irfan. Right. But when we practically apply it, on or someone tries to practically work on it, he becomes arif.
Mm-hmm.
This information changes to knowledge.
That's all right.
The people at this time, obviously, there are many people who have a lot of knowledge about many things.
Yes.
And if you ask them to talk about a topic, yeah, they might be able to talk like 24 hours or yes, 10 hours yes, or 8 hours.
Yes.
Continuously, nonstop on a single topic. But that's the point right, is that his wordings do not have any kind of effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way you said there are many people who have, like, who are talking about the nazari or the theoretical part.
Yeah,
but you can see, yeah, like, the they don't have any effect on the people as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Whereas a person who is practically,
okay,
is basically experiencing
mm-hmm,
the Irfan and he's mm-hmm, practically applying those okay, things in his life,
mm-hmm,
he has more effect.
Like, example, as we have fast food nowadays, you have fast Irfan, okay?
Yes.
We
need to remember that there's a qadib as well.
That's not Irfan.
Yeah.
That's just no, I mean,
Irfan cannot be achieved fast.
I mean, inside.
It can be. It can be. Obviously,
how?
There are different levels of souls, obviously. We need to see.
No, I mean,
uh-huh,
to, when
purely,
you say Irfan, it
yes,
really needs many, many years of spiritual exercise.
You know,
and
yeah,
one thing which is very, very much famous in the field of Irfan is that
yes,
the ulama, they said, like, if you practice a specific, we can say, practice for at least 1 year,
okay,
after 1 year, you will start seeing the effects.
Uh-huh.
On top of that, we can see, like, Ayatollah Behjat,
yes,
Rizwanullah Ta'ala alayhi,
yeah,
he narrates it from his teacher, Allama Qazi.
Qazi, Ayatollah Qazi, Sayyid Ali Qazi.
Sayyid Ali Qazi Tabatabai.
Right.
He says that he said to us that if you pray on time,
mm-hmm,
your 5-time prayers,
yes,
and after some time, if you don't see anything, any ranks or
okay,
any kind of enlightenment in you,
yes,
you can come and spit on my face. So basically, there are different levels. On top of that, we have other Arafah. For example, in Qom, we had the Kazim Karbalai.
Karbalai Kazim, right.
Karbalai Kazim.
No,
he got the Hifz of Quran, like he got the Quran in the old age.
Yes.
And this is also, we can refer it towards the Irfan. Obviously.
He was an illiterate man.
He was illiterate
yeah,
man, and he was given the, we can say, knowledge of Quran.
Yes.
By Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
By heart, therefore.
Yeah, in a spiritual experience.
In a spiritual
yeah,
experience.
Yes.
When they ask him, like, how did you get this? He said, just act whatever you know about religion.
Mm-hmm.
The simplest formula of Arafah
right,
is that whatever you know, just live like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the
practice what you preach.
Yes,
yeah,
practice what you know.
Okay, practice what you know, that's right.
Not what you preach, or that's
okay,
for ulama,
yeah,
alim
for ulama, yeah.
For
okay,
general people,
yes,
practice what you know.
What you
if
know,
you know lying is guna or sin,
yes,
don't lie. If you know praying on time is obviously necessary, then pray on time.
Yes.
So obviously, this is the main point, that if someone is not practicing, and that's why we have in the narrations as well, like
mm-hmm,
from A'imma, that that if an alim is not practicing what he preaches, his wordings has no effect on people.
That's all right.
And that's why we can see, unfortunately, many people preaching
mm-hmm,
or talking about religion, but practically in the society, we do not see those effects.
That's all right.
Even about the prayers,
mm-hmm,
you know, it is said like in the Salata, تَنْحَ عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ.
That's right.
The prayer stops you from doing evil.
Yeah.
Which prayer? What kind of prayer?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have not seen the effects of these prayers.
That's all right.
By, we can say, so-called, we can say, religious people.
Or we ourselves, you know,
ourselves
in our daily
well,
lives, yeah.
Because we are not practicing it,
yeah,
truly, we do not see the effects.
The salat of it without ma'rifah has no value, brother, you know? And the fasting without ma'rifah has no value. We are doing it out of what? Obligation, not to go to the hellfire, okay? Or, for example, we are Muslims, we have to do this obligation. But I think people like Allama Hassan Zada Ali believe that do every action you have by ma'rifah, and then you will see the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala inside yourself. This is what he means. Okay, anything missed about regarding Irfan and Nazari and Amali, Dr.
The only sentence that I want to add is that you can become an expert, an academic expert
mm-hmm,
in Irfan and Nazari by reading the books that
yes,
have been authored
yes,
without being called a mystic.
Oh.
So a person who is an expert in theoretical mysticism is never necessarily an RF or a mystic himself.
But if we want to know the secrets,
yes,
we have to for sure refer to,
if you want to experience the secrets, maybe some of the secrets
okay,
can be understood
mm-hmm,
somehow
yes,
not completely
yes,
somehow by reading
okay,
the descriptions
yes,
of the real mystics
yes,
so you can get to know a
okay,
portion of that
yes,
But this does not mean that you are an RF if you just read it.
Okay.
If you want to be an RF and have that experience, you need to get underway and do all of the practical requirements of that.
And for sure, we must know that all these things and mysticism and Irfan we are talking about is in line with the teachings of the Holy Quran, under Islamic laws and obligations, the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, and not deviated. Because unfortunately, we have seen examples even inside the Muslim lands, the Urafa that got deviated, and all of a sudden they claimed something big without any intuition, and just by being selective from this and that, they called themselves Arif. So mysticism and Irfan, like any other field of study, needs practices, like the Reza Zadeh,
absolutely,
to be expert in and to become for the spiritual growth of the people.
Yeah, if you're talking about becoming a mystic or an RF,
yes,
absolutely. It's all about practices. A spiritual exercise,
yes,
is what you and Sayyid mentioned. It's actually being committed to the religious laws, ritual prayers, fasting, and serving other people, and living among other people, and at the same time being a pious person.
Yes.
Doing Salat al-Layl, and you know, these types
observing
of
observing Haqq al-Nas,
exactly,
that's right.
These are the best examples of practical mysticism that
that's
can
right.
lead to the highest levels of Irfan without being isolated and separated from the society.
That's all right.
I think we need to bear one thing in our mind, that when we are talking about the Islamic terminologies, we better refer to the Arabic text.
Yes.
Because most of the, obviously, all the terminologies that we are using, these are the Arabic terminologies. And Riyadat, obviously, in Arabic, it is said to sports.
Yes. A sport, yes.
Sport.
Yeah.
Or practicing.
Yeah.
This is Riyadat.
This is a spiritual sport.
This is a spiritual sport.
Okay.
That you do, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to refer to the original words, Arabic, and then try to find out, rather than going to look at what people do say, or what
say.
Other religions have these kind of...
You know, the concept is normally in a way that can lead to these different types of interpretations.
Yes.
For example, even in Arabic, this is called riyadha. Riyadha is exercise.
Yes.
In Arabic, even, so it can be used, I mean, regular exercises that people do every day on a daily basis in order to be healthy, even that is called riyadha in Arabic.
Right. Okay.
And also a spiritual riyadha. So these are different. I mean, the examples
but we can
to
say,
be
like,
done.
Even in the Islam, obviously, the Irfan itself is knowing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you do anything that
is
you
the
do,
result of riyadha.
Yeah.
That
is
that's
the result.
No, that knowledge.
So that's why every single movement, you should do riyadha in order to become arif.
Yes.
And that can be taken as exercise, like the way you do exercise. You do on every single movement you spend.
Okay.
The
that's
way
right.
that you're exercising.
Exactly.
So it very much depends on reminding ourselves about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in any moment and second of our lives and on any actions that we have.
Sure.
And this is really difficult to reach, but people like Allama Hassan Hassanzadeh Omali showed that it is possible. Thank you very much, Dr. Reza Zadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for presence in the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you. It was about Ayatollah Hassan Hassanzadeh Omali. May Allah protect him. Dear listeners, you can visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
The Beit El Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us, and they said they with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know, we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origins said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online, videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, the claimed silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been these questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not. But those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork, or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Fariza, London.
Following a late cabinet meeting, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced his government's decision to reinstate a total lockdown on weekends in most Turkish states. The decision came after the number of daily infections with coronavirus reached more than 30,000. Erdogan also stated that during the holy month of Ramadan, the weekend lockdown and daily curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. will continue, with restaurants only serving delivery and takeouts.
During the month of Ramadan, restaurants and cafes in Turkey will only be allowed to deliver food as part of the measures against the COVID-19 pandemic, as weekend curfews will again be in place on Saturdays.
A week ago, Turkish president had refused to tighten restrictions. He said, although the number of daily infections is high, the number of those hospitalized is less. Some criticize what they call the government's double standards in dealing with the situation, as it is preventing wedding parties and home visits, while the ruling party is organizing conferences to promote for 2023 elections.
Of course, infection rates will continue to rise due to the majority not abiding by the instructions. For example, when the government eased restrictions on restaurants and cafes and were all allowed to operate without preventive frameworks, people and restaurants themselves did not abide by the measures. However, you cannot ask people to be careful and follow restriction guidance when you hold popular gatherings to promote your party for the elections. This contradicts your own statements and measures. On the one hand, they stress the need to adhere to social distancing and the use of protective masks, and on the other, they organize public conferences with public attendance.
Turkish president said that 80% of Turkish citizens live in high-risk provinces, including the capital Ankara and the biggest city in the country, Istanbul. The government now hopes that by the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the majority of Turkish citizens and residents would be vaccinated so that Turkey can welcome tourists again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A new report on household debt by the Bank of Italy has highlighted that some 40% of Italian households are struggling to pay the rent amid economic difficulties linked to the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the report, a large number of indebted families, 3 out of 10, and individuals, 4 out of 10, have said they are having trouble keeping up the payment of their rents or mortgage installments.
The work situation has worsened significantly, particularly for those who had a casual part-time job. For many, it's hard even to make ends meet. Bear in mind that pupils were forced to follow their classes online up to last week, and also for this reason, families have been under huge pressure.
Besides the economic impact of COVID restrictions, there are increasing concerns regarding the obvious effects on people's mental health. Many simply cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Not long ago, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, warned that some 5.6 million people were recorded as living in absolute poverty in Italy in 2020, an increase of about 1 million over the previous year. About 300,000 small and mid-sized firms that are especially vulnerable to the business disruptions inflicted by the pandemic have gone bankrupt.
Italy was in dire financial straits before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. It was the only G7 country not to have seen its economic growth return to pre-2007 levels after the global financial crisis, and its per capita income is the same as 23 years ago.
Siccome qualcuno parlava, no?
The health minister said all non-essential shops will stay closed for the entire month of April, even if the situation rolls back to normal. We disagreed with this approach. Shop must reopen. Italian must get back to work.
Meanwhile, a solidarity initiative to support poor families hit by the pandemic has been officially launched by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti. At least 20,000 households struggling in the middle of the pandemic will be receiving high-quality food products to ensure good meals during Easter festivities. Max Civili, Rome.
Along with a series of events held by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to mark the Land Day, Palestinian students and youth community also organized a conference. Students, residents, activists, and resistance leaders attended the conference, which was held in connection with several countries around the world to support the Palestinian cause.
We are marking the 45th anniversary of the Land Day, while about 25 countries around the world are participating to voice their support for Palestinian cause. We are stressing on our right of return to our lands and that Jerusalem Al-Quds will remain the capital of Palestine. People who marked Land Day proved they will keep fighting the Israeli occupation to gain their rights.
On the eastern parts of the enclave, near the separation fence, Palestinians also held an event stressing on their right of return to the occupied lands. They also expressed their refusal for the recent normalization of ties with Israel and considered it as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
We stress that Israeli occupiers will leave our land by force, and Palestinian resistance won't remain silent against Israeli violations of Palestinian land and rights. We call on the world to stop the normalization of ties with Israel. That gives Israel a green light to keep up its inhuman aggression and crimes against Palestinians.
We are proving that we won't give up defending our land. What happened on this day is unforgettable, and we stress that we won't allow Israel to take over our Palestinian lands. We mark this day to express that the resistance is our way to defend Palestine and force the Israeli occupation to leave.
Land Day is marked every year by Palestinians since March 30, 1976, to honor those who fell while defending their lands from being illegally seized by the Israeli government, when Israel declared its intention to annex approximately 5,000 acres of land from its Palestinian owners in several villages. The Land Day comes as Palestinians are calling the international community to stop the Israeli expansionism and land grab, vowing they will keep fighting until liberating Palestine and its capital, Jerusalem al-Quds. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
France is responsible but not complicit in the Rwandan genocide. That's the main conclusion of a report on the Rwandan genocide that the official Duclair Commission submitted to French President Emmanuel Macron. In 1994, extremist militia from Rwanda's Hutu ethnic group slaughtered more than 800,000 people from their own ethnic group as well as the Tutsis minority in a matter of 3 months. France intervened before, during, and after the genocide, but not to prevent it. François Granet, who is the author of The French State and the Genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda, says the French government's report into the issue does not go far enough.
From 1990 to 1995, French decision makers decided to maintain Rwanda in their zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutu's extremists against Tutsi before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue. Even if France did not have any intention to commit genocide, the French support had an undeniable facilitating effect on the Hutu's extremists.
Experts have proof that French authorities received many alerts during the ongoing genocide. In this video shot in Rwanda during the genocide, a French sergeant warns the French Army's chief of special operations that Tutsis are being massacred not far from where they are. But the French colonel does not react.
Complicity means help, and France allows the creation of an extremist government and its recognition by the international community. The perpetrators of genocide are welcome in France, and they find shelter in France and in Belgium once the genocide is completed. France delivers weapons before, during, and after the genocide. All this means political complicity.
Rwanda is a small country, mostly agricultural, with very few natural resources. No big deal. So why this was of interest to France?
France gives the support to dictators. If one goes down, the others will not trust France anymore. In the beginning of France-Afrique in the 60s, France abandoned one dictator and the consequences were catastrophic. Mitterrand and other French presidents swore not to abandon any other African dictator.
The report on Paris's role in the Rwandan genocide has other downsides besides trying to obscure France's real role. The probe was carried out with Parliament, where Macron's allies have a majority, refusing to give investigators full access to relevant archives. This new report highlights the responsibility of France in the genocide in Rwanda. However, this National Assembly refused to open all the archives, and French authorities still do not want to admit their complicity in the genocide. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Être libre, c'est pouvoir montrer son visage.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry, because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you, I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere, the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve. The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
Another weekend of protests in the UK, the southwestern city of Bristol, the front line of the battle against the British government's new policing bill that places new limits on protests. Demonstrators could face new fines of up to 10 years in prison for damaging a statue or memorial. The peaceful demonstration descended into violence at some point. Police were pelted, protesters pepper sprayed, and charged at with dogs. 10 were arrested. Thousands took to the streets across Britain. In Manchester, they blocked the tram lines. They were forcefully removed. 18 of them arrested. The UK police cracked down on protests since the murder of a young woman, allegedly at the hands of a police officer, has been under scrutiny. Critics have accused them of using deliberate and orchestrated tactics against the protesters. Last week, police retracted their claims that some officers suffered serious injuries during attempts to disperse a similar protest last weekend. But the government has remained uncompromising. Since the violent clashes in Bristol, it's condemned the protesters. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called the clashes disgraceful, and his Home Secretary Priti Patel described the protesters as thugs intent on causing trouble.
The contentious bill is still being debated in the UK Parliament. Critics say it gives draconian powers to the police, curtails freedoms, and does too little to protect women and girls. So far, the government has shown no sign of changing course, and those protesting against the bill say neither are they. Saeed Puriza, London.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave.
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yusuf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix